G'day sports fans, a midweek Sportsby pod coming at you. Plenty on the docket today. I'm going to go through a bit of my awards ballot for the NBA. Some awards I'll discuss more than others. I did have a little bit of a look at making all rookie teams as well, but I'll skim over that award section pretty quickly. But there are some contentious decisions out there, and I can see why some voters may go in a different direction, but I'll touch on all the major awards. I want to talk a bit of actual footy stuff as well. So I'm going to talk about the undefeated and winless team so far, when we think the first loss could come for the teams that still haven't copped one yet in 2024, and which winless teams have the best trajectory moving forward and who might be able to steal a couple of W's in the near future. And it wouldn't be a Sportsby pod if I didn't throw a bit of fantasy stuff in there. So I'm going to look at some unique trade targets. I think I'll make this a Wednesday weekly feature, and I might get some feedback from the audience in coming weeks, looking at what we call pods, players who have low ownership percentage and maybe aren't being as discussed in popular circles. So like I said, a lot to discuss. I'll chuck in timestamps so that you can skip to certain sections if you wish, but let's not waste any time and get amongst it. So I spent a portion of Monday's episode talking about why I think Nikola Jokic is the MVP. And like I said, it comes down a little bit to what you personally prefer. I don't think that there's any other players out there that can put up a serious battle to steal the MVP from Jokic. But the race for second is pretty interesting, and the seeding finishes and the overall records, I think, will dictate a little bit of that. Looking at the most improved player award. Now, traditionally, I don't like to go with a guy in his second year who has the natural development that we all expect, or someone maybe even in their third season who didn't get opportunity. And like a lot of these awards, it comes down a little bit to what you prefer. Do you prefer their team's record and their impact on winning? Is it a statistical jump that you want to see? But I think most people will have the same player for this award. And I'm picking Tyrese Maxey as my most improved. Now, he's rolling in to his fourth NBA season. He's become an all-star this year. And it really was a bit of addition by subtraction. We saw James Harden go out of the Philadelphia mix early in the year, and that's led to Tyrese Maxey becoming a bona fide star scorer in this league. So he's averaging a shade under 26 points a game, about six assists, low turnover rate as well, shooting pretty solid clips from the floor, 45, oh yeah, round up to 45, why not? 45, 37, and 87 from the line. So they're pretty respectable numbers. And I think that the big reason why I'm giving this to someone like Tyrese Maxey compared to a couple of other players I mentioned is the massive jump that he's taken from borderline star and maybe a fringe all-star to now one of the top scorers in the league. And I know that there's a big offensive boom, and that's why a lot of players are scoring more buckets than we've seen in the past. But Tyrese Maxey deserves a lot of credit for what he's done to help Philadelphia, especially while Joel Embiid's out. I was going to crunch the numbers and have a look at when Embiid hasn't been on the floor, how Tyrese Maxey's fared, but I don't think we really need to unpack it that heavily, because like I said, there are a couple of other players you could maybe give this to and you could look in a different direction. But taking that leap from pretty good star to a superstar scorer is huge in my eyes. He's ninth in scoring since the All-Star break. He's helped Philadelphia, like I said, stay afloat. So I gave it to him over someone like Kobe White, who is in a somewhat similar position, but he's had the breakout in production that's seen him kind of do similar to what Tyrese Maxey did last year. There wasn't a lot positive going on for the Bulls. And in year five, Kobe White has upped his scoring to nearly 19 points a game. I do think that he's going to be a very key piece to the future for Chicago. Can he up that to 25 points next year and challenge for this most improved award and be an all-star? That remains to be seen. I don't think he has that type of game in him, but there was a lot of us that weren't expecting him to kind of double his production from last year. I thought that he had some flashes throughout the first 3 years of his career, but then dipped last year, obviously, while the sky was falling in Chicago. But yeah, shout out to Kobe White, who I think is my runner-up. And then third place I've given to Jalen Williams, who is that second-year guy. So I'm kind of breaking my initial rule here, but I think that the impact he's had on winning for that OKC side, acting as the second fiddle next to Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, has been immense. He's nearly 20 points a game. He's shooting very, very efficient clips as well. So I think that his impact on a winning roster gives him the edge over someone like Jonathan Kuminga, who is probably next in line. Defensive player of the year. I've talked about this a little bit on socials. Don't think I've unpacked that a ton on the podcast, but I think it has to be Rudy Gobert's award. Victor Wembanyama might have a stranglehold over defensive player of the year for the next decade plus, let's be honest, and he may claim half a dozen of these in the future. But this year, we have to give it to Gobert for a couple of simple reasons. A, He's probably the best defensive player in the league. You could argue that Victor is, thanks to his stats, but I think that title still belongs to Gobert. B, he's playing on the best defensive team, and he's a huge reason for their success. And C, Minnesota's probably been the best defensive team all year, and defense is getting them wins. So winning through defense, I think, makes Rudy Gobert an easy pick for this award. Someone who hasn't been getting a lot of mention, and he was my preseason pick for the award, is Anthony Davis. He has played a shitload of games, which, again, none of us saw coming. So shout out to Anthony Davis for the stats that he's put up, because if we thought that he was going to play this many games, the Lakers would have been challenging for a top four seed, but hasn't been the case. He's on track at the moment to play a career high in games, though, which is not what I expected from Anthony Davis at the age of 30. And he's probably my third place player behind someone like Victor in second. Turning my attention to the sixth man of the year award, Naz Reid is flying up the board, and I can understand why a lot of people are picking him. I love Naz Reid personally, and I think that he's a player that could excel on, call it, 26 of the 30 teams in the NBA, regardless of who they have on their roster already. He's a fantastic backup big. As we've seen when Karl Anthony Towns has gone down, he's been able to plug a gap and be a great source of production for the Timberwolves. But when we look at this award, the sixth man of the year, right, a player that comes off the bench and produces, I don't think Naz Reid fits that brief. Now, he has started 13 games, which isn't a shitload, but I do think that needs to be taken into account when we look at Naz Reid's candidacy for this award. Again, like I said, big fan, glad he got paid in the offseason. I don't really love seeing him in Minnesota, but he started 13 of the last 14 games with Karl Anthony Towns out of the picture. And in those games, he's averaged 19 points, 7 rebounds, 3.3 made threes, and a block and a steal a game. So that's certainly inflated his per game numbers. And I can see why, as he's making his push towards the end of the year, a lot of voters might sway themselves to picking Naz Reid, but it doesn't feel right for mine. I want to be picking someone who is a very stereotypical traditional bench producer. And that might be a little bit old fashioned of me, or it might not be fair, but I think that I'm going to pick Malik Monk. When I did my big awards a couple of weeks back, actually it was just before the All-Star break from memory, I said that I wanted to see someone like Norm Powell, Malik Monk, Bogdan Bogdanovic from Atlanta. I wanted to see one of those guys win the award. And Malik Monk obviously got injured a week and a half ago. Bit of a bummer for Sacramento that he's not going to feature during the postseason. But of the 72 games, 71, 72? Let me fact check that. But of all the games that he played this season, he's played enough, obviously, but he hasn't started a single game as well, which some people might not take into consideration, but it's definitely a factor for me. There you go. 72 games Malik Monk has played, and all of them have come off the bench. He's just a tick over 15 points a game. He's really been a vital spark to that Sacramento team as well. Granted, they haven't succeeded like they did last year, and some people detract him a little bit for that, but I think that Malik Monk deserves the nod over Naz Reid. I think Naz Reid might end up winning the award, though. So watch this space, but Monk gets my vote in that category. The Coach of the Year race is pretty interesting. I've got Mark Daigneault of the Oklahoma City Thunder winning it. No huge surprise there. We thought that the Timberwolves would put themselves into somewhat of a playoff picture this season. We thought they might have been able to take the leap and become a fourth seed, but none of us expected to see them challenging for the one seed heading into the last week of the regular season. So that massive jump in W's usually coincides with a lot of credit for this award. My runner-up pick goes to Jamal Mosley of the Orlando Magic. Speaking of teams that have just vaulted themselves up the standings, again, I thought Orlando might have been in the play-in mix, maybe at best pushing for that sixth spot, but they're currently the four seed. They win a couple of games down the stretch. They might actually end up as high as three or two. So I do have questions about Orlando rolling into the postseason, but with that young nucleus that they've got, I think that they're one of the form teams post All-Star break, and Jamal Mosley deserves a ton of credit for that. You could make the same case for Chris Finch out in Minnesota, helping the Timberwolves take a leap towards the top of the Western Conference. But for me, I have Mosley and Daigneault ahead of him, and I also have Joe Mazzulla ahead of him, the head coach of the Boston Celtics. Currently, the Celtics have a 7-game gap over every other team in the league, a 14-win gap over the Milwaukee Bucks, who are second in the Eastern Conference. And regardless of what you think about Joe Maz as an actual tactician and head coach, he deserves a huge amount of credit for the fact that Boston's probably going to win 65 games. So Mark Daigneault's the winner, with Mosley in second and Joe Maz in third. And that lets me transition into the All-NBA teams. And like I said, some of the other ones I won't run through a lot, but I do want to unpack the All-NBA a little bit, because there's quite a lot on the line for some of these dudes. We know that there's extensions and supermaxes and a lot of financial incentive tied to where players finish and if they can push themselves into all NBA contention. And I think the four players that I talked about in the MVP race on Monday are absolute locks for the All-NBA first team. So at the guard spots, I know these are positionless, but I try to keep them somewhat balanced. The guard spots, I've got SGA and Luka, and then Giannis and Jokic taking up two of the other remaining places. And then you could maybe give a nod to someone like Jalen Brunson. He's been fantastic for the Knicks, and much like the praise I gave Tyrese Maxey for keeping them afloat when Joel Embiid went down, Jalen Brunson has been doing astronomical things for the Knicks when OG Anunoby and Julius Randle got hurt in particular. But I think I'm siding with picking the best player on the best team and giving the last spot on the All-NBA first team to Jason Tatum. He was my preseason pick for the MVP. I think if I was doing my MVP ballot, I'd probably have him fifth over Brunson. So it feels right to have him sitting in the All-NBA first team. Jalen Brunson makes the second team, though. Like I said, he deserves a lot of credit for the season that he's had. I'm also putting Ant Edwards in there. Another fantastic season from him and building a case towards being the best player in the league in a couple of years. I think that that's well and truly on the cards, to be honest. Anthony Davis is another bloke, like I said, that maybe will get snubbed from some of these awards, but I think he could push his way into All-NBA first contention for some people. Personally, I have him as about the seventh best player in the league this year, so that falls right in line with the All-NBA second team. Not the seventh best player going around, but his body of work over the season, I should point out. And then we're looking at a couple of other spots left, and there's a few names that I want to throw around here. I think Kevin Durant's done enough to push himself into the second team. A fantastic scorer, as we all know. He hasn't done anything different from seasons past and looks like one of, if not the best, players still in the league at the age of 35. Damn. Still averaging 27 points a game. A large reason for Phoenix's success. Try to say that 10 times real fast this season. And then the last spot on the second team, I'm going to give to Kawhi Leonard, who has his own injury issues going on at the moment, and the Clippers are starting to look like they have a couple of loose wheels. I'm not as sold on them as some other people might be, but he has been the driving force behind their season. And currently, they're still sitting in the fifth seed, and they've won 51 games as of today. So I think that Kawhi Leonard deserves a spot on the second team. And then in the third team, it obviously gets a bit tricky and tough. So bear with me as I talk this out. I didn't include Rudy Gobert, despite his defensive dominance. It feels a bit wrong, but I'll explain why in a minute. A couple of other players who just missed the mark are Paul George, Bam Adebayo. Zion Williamson came on late, but again, these teams are based on the whole body of work over the entire season, and I don't think he was great or eye-catching or performed well enough early in the season to warrant a spot on an All-NBA team, which is part of the reason why the Pelicans are still fighting for a spot out of the play-in game. But still, great season from Zion. I'm sure he'll make these teams in the future again. And the toughest omission I had to make, honestly, was Devin Booker. I left him out of the All-NBA third team because on there I put Steph Curry, who has kept Golden State afloat, Tyrese Halliburton, who was near MVP caliber type of player in the first portion of the season. He's been playing banged up, and that's hurt his numbers, and some people could quite easily swap Booker for Halliburton, and I could maybe be talked into it, but it seems like Indiana's going to hold on to a top six spot out west, so I want to credit Halliburton for that. Jaylen Brown, I defaulted a little bit to the best team, and they deserve two guys on the All-NBA squad, but Jaylen Brown has had a fantastic season. He's excelled as the Robin to Jason Tatum's Batman. And LeBron James, who you could maybe make a case for the leaving off, I'll be honest. Like, the Lakers haven't been fantastic. The dude is now rolling into his 40th year on this earth. He's got 20 years. This is his 21st season off the dome of experience. And his numbers are starting to dip. We're starting to see LeBron James regress to the norm. But as I say that, his shooting percentages are off the charts. He's shooting a better clip from three than Steph Curry this year, and he's canning 41% of his three-point attempts at the moment. It's down to 25 points a game, but he's still, like I said, been a massive driving force for LA's somewhat success this year. And playing 35 minutes a game at the age of 39, I think, is incredible for what LBJ's done. So you could maybe say that Booker deserves a spot over him based on record. You could maybe make the argument that there's a couple of other players like Zion or Rudy Gobert who have a greater impact on their team's winning. But at the moment, I've got LeBron James on my third team. So reeling them off, first team is SGA, Luka, Jason Tatum, Giannis, and Jokic. Second is Brunson, Ant, Durant, Kawhi, and Anthony Davis. And the third team, Stephen Curry, Tyrese Halliburton, Jaylen Brown, LeBron, and Domantas Sabonis, because he's put up a fantastic season individually, and without him, I struggle to think where Sacramento would be finishing. He's broke the record for the most consecutive double-doubles in a season. I'm pretty sure he has the record now for the most double-doubles period in an NBA season. And Sacramento's, again, underwhelmed a bit this year, but I think Sabonis deserves the nod over someone like Gobert, Booker, those other couple of dudes, based on what he's been doing on a nightly basis as an offensive hub for that Sacramento Kings team. All defense teams, I'll whip through these pretty quickly. A lot of the big dudes are going to get rewarded on these. So because they're positionless, just brace yourself for when you see the teams and there's seven centers out of the two teams. But my first team, obviously, I've got the guys I talked about for Defensive Player of the Year in Wemby, Gobert, and Anthony Davis. I'm giving Bam Adebayo the nod. He's a fantastic defensive player for the Miami Heat. And the last spot I'm giving to Herb Jones, maybe because it's a little bit of a homer pick, but as you watch Herb Jones as a one-on-one perimeter defender, or even post defender for that matter, he's fucking fantastic, and I love watching Herb. So I'm siding with him as my last pick for the first team. And then when I roll into the second team, I'm rewarding guards like Derek White and Jalen Suggs and a couple of other wing-type players, Jalen McDaniels from Minnesota, and Aaron Gordon, who some people might laugh at his name there, but he's had a great year. He's holding his opponents to under 50% on twos for the whole year. And I saw a graphic, I forget where it was. It was a StatMuse Twitter account or something like that. But since the All-Star break, he's holding his opponents to the lowest field goal percentage in the entire league. So he deserves credit. And the fact that I've got this far into talking all these awards, and with the exception of the MVP, I haven't mentioned any other nuggets. I think Gordon deserves a nod on one of the all-defensive teams. You could maybe make a case for KCP as well, who's in the honorable mentions, but I think that Aaron Gordon deserves it over him. And last, I'm giving Jared Allen the sniff. I know that that might be a homer pick as a Cavs fan again, but he has been huge for the Cleveland Cavaliers this season. Without him, I struggle to think where this team would be. There was a massive stretch, obviously, in December when Mobley and Darius Garland were out, and there was a lot of praise being heaped on Donovan Mitchell. But Jared Allen, and I've said this for a few years, might be our most important player as a rim presence. He's a fantastic rebounder. He's one of the best in the league. He's not a flashy type player, but he really makes a lot of mistakes. Does have rough hands, doesn't catch the ball very easily, which frustrates the shit out of me watching the Cavs, but still deserves credit for what he's done on the defensive end. So KCP, Lou Dort, Drew Holiday, a couple of the honorable mentions. I did have Jonathan Isaac here as well, who's only played 55 games, so he doesn't hit the games played threshold. Otherwise, I might have squeezed him onto the second team. A couple of other players that you usually give votes to, Alex Caruso, maybe a bit stiff to not get onto one of these teams, but I think that the other players I mentioned, you can split hairs and maybe put him on maybe over Jalen Suggs or McDaniels if you want, but it's my team. So that's how I've done it. So to recap, first team is Bam, Wemby, Gobert, Davis, and Herb Jones. And the second team, Derek White, Jalen Suggs, Jalen McDaniels, and Aaron Gordon. Oh, and Jared Allen, rather. The all-rookie first team, Keontae George, Jaime Jaquez Jr., Brandon Miller, Chet Holmgren, and Victor Wembanyama. I didn't even talk about the Rookie of the Year award because I know that there's been a lot of chat around Wemby's successes, so I won't bore you with more of that, but Wemby is going to win that in a landslide. Chet is a very distant second from the rest of the field as well, so when it comes to picking an all-rookie second team, it's pretty gross. Giving a bit more shine to the first team players, Brandon Miller has been excelling over the second half of the season, someone that I was wrong about. I thought that he might have been a bit of a bust potential, but he looks like the second coming of Paul George. So Charlotte fans will be excited by that. Jaime Jaquez Jr., he was off to a good start. And then I think it was on JJ Redick's podcast that he was talking about how the daily ins and outs of the NBA season are getting to him. And or not getting to him, that's not the right thing to say, but how that was the thing that he had to learn and was the biggest learning curve in his rookie season. So he might have slowed off a little bit, but he deserves to be on this team. And so does Keontae George, who I think is probably the best guard out of this class. No offense to Scoot or someone like Brandon Pajemski, but I think Keontae George deserves to be on the first team. Speaking of Scoot, I don't think he's going to play enough games, so I didn't put him into this team, but just some other players who might make this second rookie team. Kayson Wallace from OKC, he's had a pretty decent year as a rookie, impacting winning out there. Asua Thompson and Amen Thompson. I think Amen is the one who doesn't have enough games played at the moment. I'll fact check that as I go, but you could maybe make a case for both of these dudes, honestly, to appear on one of these teams, but I'm giving it a nod to Asua for the way that he's impacted defense on a pretty shitty Detroit team. Amen has not played enough games, so he'll miss, but Brandon Pajemski and Trace Jackson-Davis are the only other blokes really worth mentioning who are helping out the Golden State Warriors. So that is pretty much a whole recap of the major awards in the NBA. I tried to make it somewhat brief. Before I talk a bit of footy stuff, though, I want to touch on Bronny James, who declared for the NBA draft and also entered the college transfer portal in the last week or so. So this is pretty big news, I'll be honest, because it's going to be fascinating to watch and see if a team does draft LeBron James's son. If he does get drafted by, let's say, the Detroit Pistons, would LeBron actually consider going and playing for the Pistons just so he can play with his son? I'll be honest, if it was me and I had such a great reputation and I'd achieved so much in the league, playing against my son would honestly be enough in the NBA. But he has been on record, LeBron has, for years saying that he wanted to play with Bronny. So if he does get drafted, it'll be a fascinating watch to see what happens with LeBron rolling into that. But touching on Bronny again, he's got the backup move of saying he's entered the college transfer portal. So if he doesn't get drafted, he can just switch colleges and then play out his sophomore year and maybe more. Don't get a little bit sucked into what Bronny's stats are, because they do look crap. And we have to remember, he went into cardiac arrest in July and came back to play 25 games for USC in his collegiate rookie season. So 4.8 points per game is what he averaged. He shot poorly too. But Shams Charania a couple of days ago went on record and said that if you talk to NBA teams, there's a clear consensus that Bronny's already an NBA caliber defender, which I do question a little bit, but his defense has been something that's been talked about as a success and one of his trump cards in his last part of his high school career and rolling into college. So maybe that's LeBron helping kind of fan the flames, and he's told Shams to send that out there. But yeah, this Bronny watch will be fascinating and make the last half of the first round and the second round very interesting in the 2024 draft arrives. All right, let's transition into footy chat. And like I said, I want to talk about the undefeated and winless teams. Don't want this episode to be too long, but I want to spend a couple of minutes on these guys. So talking the undefeated squads first, we've got GWS, Carlton, and Geelong. And I think it's fair to say that the Geelong Cats are the team that surprised us to be sitting in this position. Huge turnaround from them after missing finals a year ago following their 2022 premiership. Looking at their fixture, you know, you give them a bit of credit for beating these teams, but so far they've played the Bulldogs, the Hawks, the Crows, and the Saints. You could maybe argue that the Saints are better than them. It's easy to say this now that we're a month into the season, but I don't think the Bulldogs are better than them. I probably would have said that at the start of the season, though, to be fair. So to get a couple of wins over those teams who are in a similar perceived position as them, fighting for a final spot, I think is a great coy, and they deserve credit for it. But at the moment, they've got North. I think they'll win that this weekend, so they should be 5-0. But then they play Brizzy at the Gabba, and I wonder if Brisbane will have more to play for than the Cats in that game, especially rolling into 5-0. They'll have a couple of wins banked up their sleeve. And then they roll into a pretty tricky stretch of games against Carlton, Melbourne, and Port Adelaide. So I think it's fair to say that while Geelong are also the surprise undefeated packet, they're probably the team that I have the least amount of faith to stay undefeated. Again, they should go 5-0 and beat North Melbourne this weekend, but Brizzy at the Gabba, followed by Carlton, Melbourne, Port, makes me think that a loss is coming in probably in April for Geelong. I don't think that's far-fetched to say. The Carlton Blues, they have Adelaide this weekend, and then ironically, after that, they play GWS and Geelong, and they're shaping up as one of the premiership favourites after their strong year last season. It's pretty similar to GWS in a lot of aspects, obviously. They fell short in a prelim, but turned their season around somewhat in the second half of the year and were able to roll towards a pretty strong finish despite coming up short against Brisbane. I think that you'd be pretty happy with how they went considering where they were in the first half of the 2023 season. So like I said, they got the Crows this weekend, and then they have a couple of other tougher ones after that Geelong and GWS clash. They've got Collingwood, Melbourne, and Sydney. So expect them to probably drop a couple over the next few weeks, but they will probably still be one of the last ones undefeated. I think I'm picking GWS, though, to be the team that stays undefeated the longest. They beat the Eagles and North. They also toppled Collingwood and Gold Coast. Now their real season kind of begins. They've got St Kilda this week. Then, like I said, they clash with Carlton, followed by Brisbane and Sydney. And it's possible they're still undefeated heading into that Sydney Derby, which would be pretty elite. So I think we can expect Geelong to win this weekend. They might lose to Brizzy. If not, they might get beaten by Carlton. I expect the Blues to drop a game to GWS. I know it's a fortnight away, but if I was picking that, I would have the Giants getting over them. So it's no shock that the two teams that are arguably premiership favourites I think are the best bet to stay undefeated for the longest. But if I had to pick one of them, I'd be siding with the Giants. Looking at the winless teams now, man, the Adelaide fucking Crows. I was one of the people all aboard their bandwagon saying that they were going to make a finals appearance. They were going to lick their wounds after falling short last year and come back bigger and better than ever. And since then, it's been pretty shithouse. They lost to the Suns in a game that had torrential rain throughout it in round one, and they nearly got over the line in that as well, some people may forget. But since then, Geelong, Freo and the Ds, three teams that I think a lot of people expect to fight for final spot, if not a spot in the call top six. And then they've got a matchup this week with Carlton, followed by the Essendon Football Club and North Melbourne after that. So I don't think we can see Adelaide get over Carlton, but at 0-4, time's running out for them to make anything of this season. Again, I was a believer of theirs in the preseason, and their midfield mix and transitioning inside 50 has looked real poor in 2024 so far. So I don't expect them to get over Carlton. They could surprise us all and pull off an upset, but then they've got Essendon and the Roos. You'd think that they win one, if not both of them, right? Essendon are a bit all over the shop as well and hard to pinpoint, but I do have faith that the Adelaide Crows can get a win in the next couple of weeks. Hawthorn, they're an interesting one. I had a bit more faith in the Hawks than a lot of people might have had, but they had Geelong, Melbourne and Collingwood in their last three, who are tougher so opponents and obviously lost to Essendon in their season opener. I thought that they might have been the team that could surprise us and vault out of that 14 to 18 range and maybe make a push for like 11th or 10th or something, but doesn't seem like they're going to be doing that anytime soon. Following the Suns matchup this week, they've got North, Sydney, and then the Bulldogs. Could be a battle of the bottom of the ladder in that North Melbourne and Hawthorn game, but I don't think I'll pick them this week against the Suns. I don't know if I'd pick them against North either. They haven't looked great this year, but you'd expect Hawthorn again to get a win in one of those next four, maybe against the Doggies, probably not against the Swans, and it might even come this week against the Suns, but again, I've still got a somewhat glass half full approach to how Hawthorn's going this season, mainly because the teams below them, on the ladder at least, I think are pretty shithouse. I talked about that North Melbourne game that's coming up in a fortnight. There's a lot of positivity for the Roos around their young guns, but their closest game so far this year has been 26 points, and that was the one they not forfeited, but gave up to the Dockers when they were four goals in front, and then a 50-point swing saw them end on the wrong side of the win-loss margin. So as a result, they're still winless. Geelong, Hawthorn, Adelaide and St Kilda to come. And if they don't beat Hawthorn in that second game, after the Adelaide and St Kilda matches, they've got the Gold Coast, Essendon and Port Adelaide. So it's very possible that we could be looking at an 0-8 or a 1-7 North Melbourne team. So again, a lot of positivity around their young nucleus and their core, but North are in for another rough season as well. West Coast, they don't look like winning a game at the moment. And as Simo said, they've actually had a hard fixture. And I kind of agree with him. They had Port Adelaide, GWS, the Doggies in Melbourne as well, and then obviously played Sydney in Gather Round. So this Richmond game that they've got coming up on the weekend is actually pretty huge for them. If they're able to get a win here, it would do great things for the club and all their young players. And if the Tigers hadn't beaten Sydney, there'd probably be a bit more riding on it. But I think it's fair to say we expect Richmond to win here. After the Tigers game this weekend, they've got the Derby, followed by a game against Gold Coast and then Essendon, Collingwood and the Melbourne Football Club. So not great signs for the West Coast Eagles. And I think that they'll have to get a win in the next couple. Maybe that comes against Gold Coast in Gold Coast. Essendon at home, maybe, you never know. I'm not high on the Dons, if you can't tell, but there's huge ramifications from this game on the weekend against the Tigers. Because if they don't get a win here, they're sitting at 0-5 rolling into a derby. The last derby they played, they lost by 100 plus points. And then, like I said, the next month of footy after that is pretty bleak. So they could be sitting 0-9, 0-10 halfway through the season. So hopefully, for West Coast's sake, they can get a dub over the Tigers on Sunday. I want to talk fantasy pods now. Everyone's looking at trading Blake Howes to Sam Closey and James Jordan to Sam Flanders. So I'm not going to give you a lot of information about that. Some people might be making both those trades. I'm probably going to do it at this stage. But there are some low ownership trade targets out there that I do just want to touch on. Some of them are a bit riskier than others, obviously, and not all these players that I'm going to mention, I think, are great trade targets specifically for this week, but there are players at least to keep an eye on. So I want to start with Jack Bowes, who I also have a complicated fantasy history with. If you remember last season, Tom Stewart went down in round one. I pivoted and traded straight to Jack Bowes to generate a bit of cash. Seems like I was just a year early because the bloke didn't do much in 2023 from a fantasy standpoint. In round four this year, though, he's gone bang with 97 points, 23 touches, kicked a couple of snags, and dominated against the Doggies from a fantasy perspective. Like I said, it is a tricky thing to kind of pigeonhole what Bowes' role is going to be week in, week out, but he had a huge CBA bump last week. He was at 63% of the centre bounces for Geelong, and they're reinventing their midfield group, I think it's fair to say. There's no Joel Selwood, obviously, anymore. Patrick Dangerfield's probably in the last season of his career. Guys like Mitch Duncan, who've been running through there for years, aren't going to be contributing a lot anymore. So a player like Jack Bowes at 26, they traded for last year and gave up pick 7 to make sure that they get him. So I think he's someone that we really could see. Well, they didn't give up pick 7, actually, did that? Doesn't matter, regardless. I think that we could see Bowes having an impact and becoming a fantasy important player. He's got North Melbourne this week at GMHBA Stadium, so maybe not the greatest forecast stat line there. And then, as I mentioned when I talked about Geelong before, they do have a couple of tougher matchups coming over the next month as well. Brizzy at the Gabba, Carlton, Melbourne, and then Port Adelaide. So Bowes is only in 0.25% of teams for a reason, but someone that I just want to flag a little bit, if he comes out and scores close to 100 again against North Melbourne and does so with a lot of heavy midfield usage, then he might generate some interest as a 550K defender. Next bloke I want to talk about will be playing against Jack Bowes and the Cats in this game, and that is Charlie Combin. Now, a -3 break even is what's stuck next to Combin's name after a massive 107 on the weekend against the Lions. I don't really love it, I'll be honest. But in saying that, as I look at it and I think about this through the whole week and don't just look at Charlie Combin's name and I look at the role he was playing, there's definitely merit in picking him. He's got a 4% ownership at the moment. Like I said, negative breaky. He dominated last week from a fantasy perspective, and there's about 7,000 coaches that are jumping on him this week. It's a risk. Don't get it wrong. He's under 400K for a reason, but we've got best of 18 rounds for the next fortnight, and it's a move that could pay dividends priced under 400K. Maybe if you go him instead of Flanders, like a James Jordan down, you can get a double upgrade next week or a coveted star midfielder in round 7. I said on the podcast, probably the rookie pod for Patreon listeners, so make sure you subscribe and check that out, but more halfback time is now the key to fantasy success. It's not more midfield time, and he took 8 marks on the weekend. Did gather 25 touches as well, which I don't expect again. But if you can take another 8 marks, that's very possible against the Cats. We could see another 70-plus score out of Combin, who, again, with a negative break-even, would rise another $50,000 to $60,000 and could be a very convenient stepping stone for coaches. So he's moving up my order of trade targets, and I don't hate the idea after initially kind of being scared off because he is Charlie Combin. Jason Horne-Francis is the next one I want to talk about. 2 games he's played, and he's produced 2 fantastic scores. So some would argue that he's not going to go out and have 30 touches every game, especially with Ollie Wines back in the mix. 111 in just 62% of time on ground, if you don't mind, is what he produced against Essendon. We might be witnessing his huge breakout. We could be seeing a 90, 85 average this season, if not more, to be honest. He was excellent, like I said, against the Bombers, but they were smashed. Like, Essendon did not put much of a fight up, and they have been giving up oodles of fantasy points lately. So it's a tiny little flag there. I'd rather look to go up in the midfield. Priced at 664, it's a bit of a tricky price point, right? Like, if you look at his draft peer, I think. No, it was the year after, sorry. But I was going to say George Wardlaw. Priced in a similar bracket, has scored okay, hasn't had the same big game that we've seen from Jason Horne-Francis, but that type of role and a young midfielder is similar vibe I get with Horne-Francis. He's obviously putting up much better numbers though. And I was on record in his draft year saying that there was times he looked like Patrick Dangerfield and there were times he looked like Patrick Lipinski, who's actually kind of turned around a bit. But regardless, I think that Horne-Francis is a little too risky for my blood. It's also worth mentioning that Port Adelaide don't have the juiciest fixture coming up. There's a lot of their games at home, but they do have Freo, then Collingwood. As I say that, St Kilda and the Crows, maybe there is merit in picking him based on the fixture. But for me, I can't really get behind it this week. Break even of 45. Freo's mids do tend to give up a little bit, but I just want to watch and see what his role is like when Ollie Wines returns, because that seems like it's going to happen if not this week, then probably the week after that. And if he is pushed into the forward line and scoring closer to 80 rather than this 111 figure, then I'd be a bit concerned about picking Horn Francis for the long term. Last two players I've kind of squashed in once here I want to talk about is the Tigers combo in Liam Baker and Shea Bolton. And part of the reason I want to talk about them is because I seriously considered Shea Bolton last week. I had to scramble, and when Alex Sexton was out, use the money that I had to try and upgrade Nick Caulfield. But it's a story for another day. Shea Bolton was at his floor, and I thought that with the West Coast matchup obviously coming this week, he could score reasonably well against St Kilda, and then he would be a viable play for a couple of weeks before his bye. Kicked four goals and had 120 points against the Saints. Fair to say I didn't see that huge score coming, but now got a break even in the 50s. It's priced under 750K, and as I mentioned, he has the West Coast matchup this week. His teammate Liam Baker, he was suspended against Sydney, so it means he didn't feature in this St Kilda game, but very, very convenient defender forward. 685K is what he'll set you back. And we've seen Bakes put up some big scores in the last couple of weeks as well. If you forget, against Sydney, he had 113, kicked a couple of snags, was laying tackles, taking marks. He was great. And the week before that against Port Adelaide, his score was inflated a bit by three goals, but churned out another 105 with 85 points the week before that. Worth mentioning, though, in round zero, we had 46, and that's part of the reason why his price has dipped a little bit. He's back up from his starting price to begin the season, but West Coast matchup makes both these boys pretty tempting, I'll be honest. I don't think you can pull the trigger considering the fact that they have the bye next week, but it is best of 18 rounds, right? And there's not a lot of Richmond and Melbourne players rolling out there for coaches. So if you have to field a Harley Reid, Darcy Wilson, hell, even Aaron Cadman for a week instead of Liam Baker or Shea Bolton, and then you roll into round seven and you plug them back on your field, and that's the difference between having another rookie or having a second tier forward, in my opinion, then I don't hate the idea of making a play for either of these Richmond boys. They should both get 90 plus without too much fuss against West Coast. And if I had to pick one, I think I'd be going with Shea Bolton over Liam Baker. But yeah, the bye next week does make it a little bit tricky. Last minute of the podcast, I want to talk about the teams for Brisbane and Melbourne, mainly because Colton Tholstrop has been announced to debut. Now, if you know about this kid from WA, Subiaco product, he's a quite a explosive type player. He was likened a bit to a player like Cam Zerha, but I think he's going to take a bit of time before we see him produce those type of highlights in the big time. But he's raved about by a lot of Melbourne people. They really rate him internally. There was talk of him even making a debut in round one or opening round. So be cool to see him play. He might just be a couple of week wonder or demoted to the sub. He's straight in at the moment for Cozzy Pickett, and I don't think you can pounce on him, especially on a Thursday night team. It just feels a bit risky, but 264K forward, he might be someone after his bye in round six that we target in round seven as a downgrade option. So shout out to the Tholstrop for getting his AFL debut. He could run a mark against Brizzy and churn out a 60-odd, but I think the smart move is to wait for the fantasy coaches out there. And that's it. That's all I've got for this hump day edition of the Sportsby Pod. I'll be back on Friday looking at the teams, doing a little bit of a review, or preview rather, of round five in the AFL season. And I think when I do that, I'll talk a little bit about the NBA play-in as well. I've kind of taken a seat back and just watched a couple of games, but also looked a little bit at potential matchups rather than watching too much basketball or the doldrums of the regular season. So you can check out the Patreon page. I'll be dropping the rookie tiers tomorrow. And then Friday, I'll be dropping the rookie roulette, talking about which players you can field in which positions. Tricky business, but I've been pretty good nailing that so far. Last week was a bit of a schmozzle, but I backed myself in to right the wrongs for too long. But as always, I do appreciate you listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time. We'll